Right now, it's time to welcome in David Tarachuk. David joins us, of course, every Friday morning at this time. We also rebroadcast David on the weekend and during our 12 noon block. And we say Happy May Day, David.
Yeah, Happy May Day to you, Marshall. I'm calling in from New York City, the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic, in the United States at least. It's a rainy day, but the mayor of our city is claiming that things are going to get better. But the measures still have to be kept tightly in place, and they're now in our city handing out to the public masses and masses of masks. At public places, you can just show up today and get your own mask. The city wants to make it as easy for us as it can, evidently.
Well, and along with that, the good news in Connecticut is that 9 days in a row, the hospitalization rate is down. If it gets to 14 on May 20th, assuming things hold steady, a slow reopening of the state will start to happen under very strict controls. But I guess we can say, hopefully, there is light at the end of the tunnel. But, you know, David messaged me and sent me his copy that he put up on his website, by the way, themediabeat.us. David's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. But right at the top of themediabeat.us today is the following entry. May Day message, clarity versus obfuscation in a time of disease. So I guess we can get right into this this article and this column that you've written today.
Well, sure. Let me paint a picture for you. There's a president crazily at odds with medical science, a nation's reeling from disease rampaging through its ranks. But the man at the top merely sows confusion all the time and vindictively punishes those who might contradict him. I mean, that may sound familiar to you. But let me add something that may appear totally fantastical. But an ex-president who's fondly remembered as a unifying national icon, he speaks up for rationality and clarity and for a strong new policy to counter the disease. He's lashed politically by the incumbent president, but this former president eventually wins the day and the nation finally beats back the disease. Sounds a little fanciful, doesn't it? But this is, in fact, a true record that I'm very familiar with of actual events in another country, South Africa. Not so long ago, and as you know, I did a lot of reporting on South Africa. I didn't know Mandela well because I only met him once, in fact, but I was much more familiar with his successor, Thabo Mbeki, and my familiarity with him dates way back to the time when Mandela was still in jail, and Thabo Mbeki was essentially Mandela's spokesman on the outside. Mandela was in prison for a life sentence, he thought at the time. He eventually got released after 27 years, of course. But Thabo Mbeki was in exile. He couldn't go back to his own home country, but he was in exile elsewhere in Africa. And he was essentially a spokesman. And I made a documentary about the African National Congress, which took an awful long time to make, and I spent a lot of time in company with Thabo Mbeki, who was a kind of a wayward character. He was mercurial. He was affable enough with me, and yet very quick to take offense, and very, in some ways very sensitive. My point about Mbeki is that he did succeed Mandela, but then started to behave very erratically. South Africa was going through a serious upsurge of HIV/AIDS. There were about 11% of the entire population, that's 4 million people, were affected by the disease. But Mbeki, instead of tackling this disease seriously and head on, he started promoting the theories of people who were called denialists at the time. People who claimed that HIV did not cause AIDS, and Mbeki was seem to be convinced of the idea that HIV didn't cause AIDS, but poverty in general, and in particular malnutrition and poor housing conditions, were much more important as causal factor for AIDS than the HIV, you know, the human immunodeficiency virus itself. So you had this extraordinary situation in which the president was doing nothing. He was kind of fiddling while Rome was burning, and the president, well, I happen to know that where he was getting his information from. He was, with a large bottle of whiskey at his side, he was spending all his nights cruising the internet and coming up with wacky ideas like light therapy. Can you imagine that? Light therapy certainly echoed more recently in our president's musings, let's put them that, like that, musings that he later said was just sarcasm, that that somehow or other light would cure the problem. Well, you had this really tense situation in South Africa. The medical establishment was horrified by what the president was doing, and one of them in particular, who was the head of the Medical Research Council, sort of the Dr. Anthony Fauci of South Africa at the time, he decided to go to Mandela, the immediate past president, and say, in fact, what he did say was that Mbeki was acting in a way that could be could cause a genocide, the greatest genocide of our time, he said. So Mandela got into gear and used his position as a well-trusted, iconic figure, and he started criticizing Mbeki, which infuriated Mbeki, of course, and there was this horrible scene in the National Executive of their party, the African National Congress, where Mbeki just unleashed his supporters, who started to ravage Mandela, and a man I know who was witness to all of this inside the National Executive described it at the time as a pack of wild dogs tearing apart their prey, the aging Nelson Mandela, and he said that Mandela, he told me that it had a shattering effect on Mandela, making him look, what he said was, twice his age and old and ashen. But, you know, Mandela wasn't daunted. He carried on speaking internationally about AIDS, World AIDS conferences, and he took a very important action at home, too. He visited one of the most prominent activists for AIDS sufferers, an AIDS sufferer himself who was on a kind of medicine strike. He refused to take the antiretrovirals that he knew would help him until Mbeki, the president, agreed to have those same medications made available to everybody in the country who needed them, because Mbeki was questioning their effectiveness. So Mandela went to meet this man, sat at his bedside, and then put on a T-shirt that the activist had designed himself, a white T-shirt with the words HIV positive on it, and he walked out in public wearing this T-shirt. So it was a huge... The photograph went viral, if you'll pardon the phrase, and it was suddenly an open battle over this issue of which president was right about this issue. And Mbeki was, in fact, in the end, defeated. He saw in the end that he had to give in to public pressure and made antiretrovirals thoroughly available, and of course it turned the tide, and in a sense it turned the tide for Mbeki too. He ended his term of office in complete ignominy in 2008, and there lies, I think, some kind of parable. I'll go no further than that, but I think it's important to be, you know, really concerned when your president is at odds with proven science.
Well, you know, it's it's a stunning parallel, and I don't think anybody would have thought about it. But with you digging this up from your memory banks and from your covering South Africa, it's an amazing parallel to what we have going on in the country today. And what ties into the country today is with social media. When a president acts basically through Twitter now, or and reaches out instantaneously to his 35% to 37% of people that absolutely follow him, it even makes it a slightly more dangerous and slight and a lot more important for former presidents to stand up and do what happened there, but only in this country.
It takes a lot of courage to stand up against the president, especially when there's a kind of unofficial rule amongst the club of former presidents not to do that. But and there was something about the clarity of Mandela's position, which I think was so inspiring. I mean, he gets the credit for an awful lot of good things and an awful lot of amazingly wise sayings that he didn't, in fact, ever say. But one thing was important to recall here, I think, especially in view of a situation in which a president is sowing confusion. And in the course of that, and it's fundamental to it, I think, is using his words at the bully pulpit, you know, the presidential podium, to use its nickname from, I think, Teddy Roosevelt. You can stand at that podium, and it's really important what words you choose. Being presidential is not just a matter of gripping the podium and sounding severe and firm. You also have to be precise in the words you choose, which is not a not a hallmark of this president. But let me quote something from Mandela about that. He actually talked to one of these international AIDS conferences. In fact, the first one he addressed very early on during this battle that he was having with his successor. And he said this, I think it's really important. It is never my custom to use words lightly. If 27 years in prison have done anything for me, it was to use the silence of solitude to make us understand how precious words are and how real speech is in its impact on the way people live and the way they die. That's a very serious-minded president taking a subject very seriously with exactly the right concentration on precision and clarity that you would really welcome in a nation's leader.
And, you know, we talk about this on that parallel, but also the leader of a nation is in a crisis. Is not only expected by the population to handle the crisis with the fellow arms of government, but also a consoler. I mean, we've used the term consoler in chief. Every president since I've been alive has had the ability, whether it's been John Kennedy with the Cuban Missile Crisis, whether it's been Lyndon Johnson with the shooting of President Kennedy and the Civil Rights Movement, whether it's been Ronald Reagan and what happened with Iran, whether it's been George Bush and how he consoled the nation after 9/11 and Barack Obama after the terrible collapse of the markets. Every one of these presidents has had a chance, unfortunately, in their presidency to stand up and console and guide the nation towards the light, not towards the dark. And it covers both Republicans and Democrats, and it's just amazing. And you know, nowadays, it's not even just the president, but the Senate and the House. There's just no ability to console and make the nation feel good about itself and try to move forward.
Well, it's an interesting double act going on from that presidential podium, as I mentioned, and the leadership in the Senate. The combination of Donald J. Trump at one end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and Mitch McConnell at the other end of it, suggests to me that we've now got a leadership which is not distinguished, I don't think, by that essential human quality of empathy. The message of Mitch McConnell to the states, the various American states that are in terrible financial situation now because of coronavirus, was to go for the road of declaring bankruptcy with all the sort of horrific chaos that would involve for many Americans. And of course, he had to walk that back finally and see the error of his ways. But that's the instinctive route that this kind of politician we now have at the top, as I say, at both ends of the constitutional road between the White House and the Capitol building, both of them distinctly lacking in empathy, and yet quite determined to just drive through and impose, you know, policies that may wreak havoc, but who cares if it keeps their party in power? That seems to be the message.
You know, after listening to you compare this situation to what happened in South Africa, what also is, I think sometimes the media lets this slip by. Definitely, I think people let this slip by, and possibly even a lot of people who are in the leadership in our country, and both the Senate and the House and the President, and that is that. Even though some states like Connecticut and other states are starting to see the light, even New York City, things are improving, this is unlike anything in anybody, basically 90% of the people inhaling and exhaling in this country right now have ever witnessed. It's far different than the collapse that happened with the banks. It's far different than the wars, because this is a virus that, until a real secure and a real operative fix to it can be found with a vaccination or all the tracing is done, we're going to have to deal with this on a major level and act like adults and not go out of bounds or over the top, probably for the next year or so at least.
Yeah, and it's not a war that is fought overseas, affecting a small proportion of our citizenry. Every single person is in to some degree, many much less than others. Everyone's at risk in a sense, and of course that's something that really hasn't occurred in this country, and no one under the age of 102 or so, I don't think, can recall anything quite as bad and as quite as closely threatening to individuals as this situation is, and it brings out the best in politicians sometimes. Something like this, major crises are a time when real leadership can be demonstrated, and it's going to take. I'm not sure if we're going to see it in the lifetime of this presidency, but sometimes situations like this are educative, and presidents learn to change, as even Mbeki did. I have to give him credit for that finally, although he did it with very bad grace. There are people who are politically minded who think that the only answer now is to vote this president out and vote a different one in, and that may be one over simple answer to it, but what is certainly needed is a massive change in what happens and what comes out of White House as the White House is messaging for the nation as a whole. As I say, a distinct lack of empathy. It's not the best leadership that you could possibly have in a crisis that affects every individual in the country to some extent.
And you see that leadership a couple of weeks ago when the president tweeted "Free Wisconsin, Free Michigan." Well, yesterday, because there's an open carry law that allows people to carry, if you're licensed, guns, people with automatic rifles basically came into the state capitol when they were going to vote on the emergency actions. They stood in front of the governor's door. It's a sight to behold and a sight to be sad at the same time.
Right, and it and that kind of bold, rebellious action, heroic to some people, I suppose, but it certainly smacks of subterfuge, of a form of rebelliousness and puerile rebelliousness that owes its origins, I think, in large degree to the simplistic notion of make America great again. To use one of the president's own favorite words of dismissal, it's sad.
It is sad. Now,
and I mean it literally in the way that Nelson Mandela would want to use words precisely. It is very sad.
Very, very sad. And now I can't let you go without asking about, we can talk about the media coverage of it or what's behind what's going on in North Korea with Kim Jong-un. I mean,
Well, our president is obviously privy to some information that makes him say that he hopes Kim Il-sung. I'm sorry, the name always trips me up, even if I haven't got a cough. Kim Jong-un is supposedly ill. Well, our president believes he is ill, and believes his and hopes that he gets better. I mean, it's so cheering to see such solidarity amongst people with a tendency towards dictatorship. I'll put it no stronger than that. As we know, North Korea is an almost impossible country to report on accurately, and you know, we just don't know, and American intelligence sources are as unclear about the situation as laymen everywhere, laymen and women everywhere. But the president, our president, seems to believe he knows what's going on, while at the same time saying from that same podium again, to this time to the press corps, that. That he knows, but he can't tell you. I'm not allowed to tell you. That doesn't seem to the concept of this president not being allowed to do something isn't really something we're very familiar with. Coming, you know, when it comes out of his own mouth, there are various things that he's not allowed to do that he's perfectly happy to do regarding, you know, his constitutional role, for instance. But though he's he's aware of some information, he claims, he's not allowed to tell us what it is. And I think we have simply got to be patient with the North Korean situation, and eventually we'll find out if the man has had a serious operation or whether he's perhaps even dead without us knowing it. And we know perfectly well that hardline autocratic regimes like that can keep the death of a leader secret for some time, though, of course, not forever.
What I don't understand is why the press does not press the president and push the president when he makes statements like "I know more," or like he makes statements about injecting disinfectants. Why the press
doesn't... Amusing. A question. He was posing a question, or he was being sarcastic.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, press corps behavior in the White House is a matter of great difficulty. Let's put it that way. Each and every journalist in there owes it to their own employing organization to keep their place in there. It's not easy to become a member of the White House Press Corps. And once you're there, it's really incumbent upon you, as far as your own boss is concerned, that you stay there. It's been very well demonstrated that this administration is perfectly capable of freezing people out and denying them their press credentials. And now, of course, every time that's attempted with an individual, it causes a great fuss. But it's obvious that it's a risky game standing up to this president. It applies to people in the administration too. It's shocking that Dr. Anthony Fauci should say that while the president may be saying things that are totally inaccurate, he feels he cannot go to the microphone and push him away and contradict him. Well, he wouldn't do that in actual fact, but he could certainly firmly and clearly say, the president's wrong here. But of course he doesn't dare. And the reason is perfectly obvious. He'd get fired if he did. Now, is he strong enough to take that risk? Is his position strong enough to take that risk in the country at large? That's an open question. But I'm sure, pretty well sure, that not a single journalist in that room has the strength, the individual strength, to counter the president and still retain his position.
I'll just wrap it up with just this one thing. The song from Simon and Garfunkel, Where Have You Gone, Joe DiMaggio. I would like to sing Where Have You Gone, Sam Donaldson. If you
the strong voice in the press corps. Yeah, well, he used to be a bit of a pain with that. Yeah. But yeah, the principle is clear. You know, you shout back at the president if you have to. If you really have to, you ought to.
David, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us again this morning, and we'll check with you next week.
Thank you. Look forward to that.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. Of course, you can hear it on weekends and also during our new news block, and always 24 hours a day at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.